You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Today is the day that we celebrate the birth, life, and well, you wouldn't celebrate the untimely death, but the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How have we done since then? Over at Wonk Blog, there's a whole set of charts. It's just fascinating. The black unemployment rate has consistently been twice as high as that of the white unemployment rate for 50 years. That gap has not changed. For the past 50 years, black unemployment has been well above recession levels. The gap in household income between blacks and whites has not narrowed in 50 years. In fact, the wealth disparity between whites and blacks is even wider now than it was when Ronald Reagan came into office. The black poverty rate declined dramatically in the 60s and 70s. Reagan came into office, and it's been flatlined ever since then, since the 1980s. Black poverty at around 28%. It was 26% when, it was 30% when Reagan came into office. And it is 28% right now. Not good. Our schools are actually more segregated now than they were in 1980. This is progress. I think we have some work to do. Demetrius Miner is with us. He's a member of the National Advisory Council, Project 21, blogger and former conservative talk show host. Demetrius, D-E-M-E-T-R-I-U-S, speaks.com is his website. Demetrius, welcome to the program.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. I've read this this blog that you sent out, and in it there's a quote, and I think you sent this along. You're quoting Bishop Ned, though. Dr. King was a Bible-believing pastor who understood Scripture. He would be doing precisely as the Bible suggests and rejoicing about all the good that has been accomplished instead of sitting around and looking for something to complain about. When the average net worth of a white family in the United States is $79,000 and the average net worth of a black family in the United States is only $5,000, isn't it more than just complaining to point that out and suggest we should do something about it?
Well, just for clarification, that was not what I quoted. I think you're referring to a different individual. But in retrospect, when we think of the era that Dr. King lives in, and if you compare it to the era that me and you currently live in, I think that we both can agree that there has been some progress. Now, of course, in regards to economics, there's much work that needs to be done. And, you know, there's various ways to do that. Through jobs and through growth and the appropriate economic resources in different states, you know, that's a whole different conversation right there.
Well, let's have that conversation. I mean, I've actually lived through both. I was born in 1951. I remember segregated water fountains. I remember whites only entrances when I was a little kid. I remember a park that was whites only. I remember segregated schools, and I grew up in the North in Michigan, and I remember the 60s. I remember that the war on poverty, when Lyndon Johnson launched the war on poverty, not only did he cut the overall poverty rate in the United States more than in half over the following 6 years, but that he really created a launching pad for a black middle class that was just really having a hard time getting off, off the ground, with the possible exception of people who had been in the military throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, then basically along came Reagan and said, we're going to stop all this stuff. And then Clinton, we're going to end welfare as we know it. Many of the Great Society programs have been dialed back. And basically ever since Reagan, it's been frozen. As a black conservative, how can you justify that?
Well, Tom, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with you. Lyndon Baines Johnson intentionally said, if you go back and if you listen actually to the LBJ tapes and how he referred to the black population in the derogatory term that I will not use on your radio show, but basically how he will be using black people to vote for the Democratic Party for the next 200 years.
I've heard that quote quoted by conservatives before, and I can't find any original source for that. Can you provide me with one?
Well, I surely don't have it sitting in front of me.
The last time I had this conversation with a conservative was about 4 or 5 months ago on my TV show, and he said that LBJ said that if he gave African Americans enough welfare that they would vote for Democrats for 200 years, and I didn't have a response, and so I came back and I started Googling, and all I could find was sites that's either white supremacist or right wing sites that said that, and maybe a dozen different ways that it was quoted, or debunking sites saying LBJ never said any such thing. I cannot find a single original source for LBJ saying that. If you could provide it to me, I would very much appreciate it. But
I will provide you with this. The Great Society has been detrimental to the black family. What it has done is it has increased dependency upon governmental programs and welfare programs, which was intentionally used to be a temporary means to living, but not permanent settlement. And if anything, what I have seen in my lifetime, I have seen different left-wing individuals use governmental programs as a way to keep the black individual captive instead of promoting free enterprise, free market.
You can't be on welfare for more than 5 years now, since the Clinton-Gingrich reforms, without getting a job.
Well, what I'm telling you,
benefits go away.
I'm not just talking about welfare. I'm talking about the promotion of big nanny government, where the government will take care of you instead of promoting.
But the fact of the matter is that since these so-called reforms that rolled back what LBJ did, we have seen unemployment remain stable and in some cases get worse. We've seen poverty remain stable and in some cases get worse. And those numbers actually improved dramatically in the 60s and 70s. I mean, dramatically. Black poverty fell, black unemployment fell, and then along came Reagan, and it has been flat. I mean, you can just look at the graphs.
Actually, I disagree with you, Tom. One of
the numbers.
Black entrepreneurship was during the Reagan years. Now, if my understanding was that you wanted to discuss the legacy of Martin Luther King, I was unaware that we was going to compare and contrast economic policies of previous presidents.
So what's his legacy in your mind? We have a minute.
Well, I mean, obviously, from the conversation that we are having now, seems like there needs to be work to be done. There's lots of work that needs to be done. And Martin Luther King's legacy will forever live. I mean, there's peace, there's courage, the dare to dream, to go from rags to riches and to arise from the chasm of hate and racial bigotry, to bridging that divide, to serving one another.
I don't see him as a rags-to-riches guy. He was, when he was shot, he was asking for janitors to be able to unionize. That's not riches.
Well, I'm saying that it inspires anyone to go from rags to riches, to know that, one person, if they believe in their heart that they can change the world, and they can do it, they can be whatever they want to be. And that varies from, whatever your economic status may currently be, poor, if you're middle class, you can.
I got it. Demetrius, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but Demetrius Minor, DemetriusSpeaks.com is the website. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. What is the legacy, in your mind, what is the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Andrew Campbell on the line with us, senior producer over The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So in our first half hour of the program tonight, we're going to have a bigger picture conversation about Martin Luther King and this day today.
Yeah, we'll be talking about his legacy, look at how current events are really shaping or not shaping the beliefs that he had for America before he was tragically taken from us. And we'll be talking to Brian Miller from the executive director of United for a Fair Economy. We'll also be talking to Thena Robinson-Mock, who's an attorney and project director for Ending the Schoolhouse to Jailhouse Track with the Advancement Project. And then finally, we have Hillary Shelton on, who we've had on before. He's the director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP. So it should be a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, I think so, too. And then Greg Palast.
Yep, investigative reporter Greg Palast is going to be on. We're going to be talking about Chris Christie. Obviously, he's been in the news over the past few weeks for the Bridgegate scandal, and now for apparently his lieutenant governor may have issued an ultimatum to Hoboken, New Jersey about Sandy Hurricane Sandy relief money. So that's really what's taking up all the attention today. But while the mainstream media is focusing on those issues, there's a lot more skeletons in Chris Christie's closet than a lot of people know about, so we'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. And some of them apparently have to do with the Koch brothers,
yep.
At least according to Greg.
Chris has connections to the Koch brothers.
Yeah, we'll find out what Greg has to say about that. And are millennials becoming more liberal?
Yeah, we'll be talking to Altima Omara. She is the president of the Young Democrats of America. She's the group's first African-American president, and we'll be talking about a new study released by Gallup, which shows that the identification as liberal by millennial generation is really on the rise, and we'll talk about what that means and its implications for politics in America.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And then our Daily Take tonight.
Yeah, Daily Take. You're going to be talking about net neutrality. Obviously, it was a decision passed last week by the U.S. Circuit of Appeals here in D.C., and they basically struck down the Obama administration's net neutrality rules. And while that sounds complicated, we're going to really break it down and talk about what it means for the American consumer and what a internet without net neutrality would look like for how you would access a search engine site or how you would access a video site. So it's fairly interesting, and it's a great meme to get out there.
And what would it look like?
Basically, you're going to be charged for everything you want to do. You'd have a very basic internet package for, say, $29.95 a month, but that doesn't include being able to go on Google, doesn't include being able to go on Amazon, doesn't include being able to watch a video on Netflix. That would all be additional costs, and quickly you're going to see that without net neutrality, the internet, which is supposed to be open and free for all, is turning into a luxury good.
Either that, or the flip side of it could be that those individual companies, Amazon and whatnot, that they'll start having to pay the internet service providers in order to have fast pass through to you and me, and so we'll see their prices go up. So
either way, we're getting screwed.
Yeah. Netflix's prices will go up for a membership, or Amazon Prime will become more expensive, or whatever. And it's another opportunity for Comcast and Verizon to become the richest companies in the world. Amazing. Andrew Campbell, thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
See you tonight. We'll be back. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And did you know that Martin Luther King actually called for not only the government to be the employer of last resort, but to be a good employer? For the government to actually come up with high-quality jobs? He came up with what he called a Bill of Economic and Social Rights. And the King Center has the original of it on their website that you can track down relatively easily. And he was calling for us to establish jobs. Now, FDR had called for the same thing 20 some odd years earlier, but basically calling for a job to be considered a right. So that if capitalism failed, when capitalism fails, when capitalism hiccups, when capitalism goes through those periodic boom and bust cycles and crashes, as it does, as Martin Luther King Jr. himself pointed out, it does. He said that we have a national responsibility to provide work for all. We the people, the United States of America, the government. And he said these should not be just make work employments. He said they should be careers. There's enough stuff that needs to be done, and enough of it that's not just, hey, let's dig holes and then fill them up, you know, but real stuff. He said there are literally millions of creative public service jobs which could be opened up for the poor at a minimal cost and in short order. These are not make work employments. They are new careers. He also echoed Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine suggested in Agrarian Justice that every American at birth, that basically a bank account should be created for them and funded by the government that they would have access to after they become 21 and could be a foundation of wealth, that everybody would have a certain amount of wealth. And, you know, there have been others who have suggested, and there's this movement. We've talked about it. In fact, we've had guests on this program from the guaranteed minimum income movement in Europe who are suggesting, and this is, I think it's going to be on the ballot in Spain this fall, but it's going to be in one of the European countries, who are suggesting that everybody gets a certain minimum income. You know, for lack of a better word, an actual, you know, a certain minimum guaranteed income, whether they work or not. And Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called for the same thing. His second right, the first was the right of a job. The second was the right of a minimum income. He said that we've got this patchwork of programs that are utterly inadequate and largely discriminatory. Let's do away with those and just replace them not do away with them. He says, however, in urging a guaranteed income, we most emphatically do not believe, as some conservative proponents of the idea do, that it will be a substitute for the entire welfare state. It's one element. And he also wanted it to be fixed so that as GNP goes up or as cost of living goes up, that this guaranteed national income goes up. This was not just for African Americans, it was for white kids as well. It's for all people. Actually, the income, I mean, for their parents. The third right that he called for was the right of a decent house and a free choice of neighborhood. And he said we should eliminate all the slums in America over the next 10 years. He suggested that we should have a right to an adequate education. He was talking about how schools that are basically all black. Well, I'll quote Dr. King. He said, quote, Negro schools are regularly so inferior that a good portion of the students are not even taught the basic educational skills and therefore become bored, resentful, and drop out at the first opportunity, end quote. So let's upgrade those. And then he said, you know, upgrade education available to the black and white poor. He called for a peacetime GI Bill. Basically, you know, let's do what we did after World War II. Send people off to school so that young men and women can go to college after we've taken care of good elementary schools, primary schools. He wanted another right he felt everybody should have is the right to participate in the decision-making process. Get involved in politics. the right to the full benefits of modern science in health care. Basically, everyone should have health care. And then he talked about how, you know, but people are going to say we can't afford this because of the war in Vietnam. Well, we should end the war in Vietnam and fund these programs instead. It's sort of like the let's end the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and rebuild America first, you know, Merle Haggard's song. Let's rebuild America first. This is the man who called the Vietnam War immoral, who called poverty immoral, who said that we should be working toward a society that is not only colorblind, but also is class blind. Basically, you know, no more poverty in the United States, the richest country in the world. We should not have poverty in this country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And instead, what do we have? Well, since the 1980s, basically not much. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. And I mentioned that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. suggested that every citizen should have a right to a minimum income. And, in fact, literally every citizen, not just those who are able to work. Earlier he had suggested everybody should be able to have a job, but then he said almost half of the poor in America, both black and white, are either too young, too old, or too handicapped to work. And then he goes on about how our welfare system is really not meeting their needs, and we should have a minimum income program for everybody. Well, Moises Velasquez Manoff, writing on January 18th, that would have been Saturday, in the New York Times opinion pages, the headline, "What Happens When the Poor Receive a Stipend?" In other words, what happens if you actually take poor people and give them money so that they're not poor anymore? Moises, I'm assuming it's a he. I might be wrong. It might be a she. It's a name I'm not familiar with. I'm sorry. But anyhow, Moises Velasquez Manoff says, growing up poor has long been associated with reduced educational attainment, lower lifetime earnings, higher risk of depression, substance abuse, other diseases, degenerative disease in adulthood. Talks about, you know, the problems associated with poverty and multi-generational poverty and all these kind of things. And so they say, okay, there's been an example of what happens if all of a sudden a group of people who for years and years and years, literally generations have been poor, if suddenly they all have a minimum income, $6,000 a year. And the group that they were looking at was a Cherokee tribe that opened a casino, and the casino income was $6,000 per person per year for all of the members of that tribe. So they started passing the money out to everybody, just like they do with the Alaska Permanent Fund. Just like, you know, when Sarah Palin was governor, she would write a check for $2,000 every year to every man, woman, and child. So if you've got, you know, four people in a family, you get four checks, $8,000. For example, married or not, it doesn't matter. So this was $6,000 per person. And Moises writes, just 4 years after the supplements began, Professor Costello observed marked improvements among those who moved out of poverty. The frequency of behavioral problems declined by 40%, nearly reaching the risk of children who had never been poor. Already well-off Cherokee children, on the other hand, showed no improvement. So this is a classic example of you got a problem, throw money at it. It actually solves the problem. If the problem is poverty, you can throw money at it, and it does work. Minor crimes committed by Cherokee youth declined. On-time high school graduation rates improved. By 2006, the supplements had grown from $6,000 a year up to $9,000 a year. The casino was making even more money. And Professor Costello could make another observation. The earlier the supplements arrived in a child's life, the better that child's mental health was in early adulthood. Just lifting people out of poverty. Better mental health. They were one-third less likely to develop substance abuse or psychiatric problems in adulthood. One-third less. On the other hand, when the money didn't start arriving until they were already 14 to 16 years old, it didn't make any difference. So this is like, we really need to intervene when, with regard to poverty. We really need to intervene when children are young. So what does that money do? Well, it, you know, the money which amounted, quoting from this New York Times piece, the money which amounted to between one-third and one-quarter of poor families' income at one point seemed to improve parenting quality. The supplements eased the strain of feast or famine existence. Once the energy spent fretting over such things as, you know, buying food, making the rent, eased up, that, quote, helps parents be better parents, quoting Vicki Bradley, a tribe member and tribal health official. They found a similar project, a parallel study at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This was on 1,300 mostly poor rural children in North Carolina and Pennsylvania. Working memory and executive function. You know, executive function, the ability to restrain yourself and make rational decisions and all that kind of stuff, have an inverse relationship with poverty. Working memory and executive function, by the age of three, working memory and executive function show an inverse relationship with the stressors experienced by parents. Early life stress and poverty correlated with a shrunken hippocampus. That's the part of the brain that is the one-day scratch pad that controls memory, and the amygdala, brain regions for, and the amygdala controls your emotional responses to things by and large. Brain regions important for memory and emotional well-being, respectively. They've done these studies on rats. They've seen the changes in the brains that the equivalent of poverty produces. We should be able to see it in humans. Tony in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Tony. What's up?
Hey, Tom. I was just calling to say what I thought Dr. King's legacy was.
Mm-hmm.
I think we get too caught up in, you know, the I Have a Dream speech, the marches, da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
People are not looking at what the man inspired in other people. Black people were living under terrorism. I mean, let's just be real. Any white person could, you know, if I walk on the wrong side of the street or bump into you or whatever, you know, lynch mobs could come get me, kill me. My mom almost got killed.
Whoa.
The same way. And I was born in 1961, so I'm, you know, not a spring chicken either. But when I think about growing up, how the terrorism we lived under, you had all these humiliating things you had to do to survive, because anybody white could, you know, put you in jail, kill you, whatever.
It is still going on. Trayvon Martin.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. And that's why that Negro pen guy you had on earlier, those type of people get on my nerves, because they don't ever really look at the true history. And like you said, and not much has changed. You know, so blame it on Democrats. Give me a break. Republicans aren't the answer either. The answer that black people are going to have to start doing is keeping your money in your pocket. That is the bloodless revolution that we have to do today. Because now that black folks are total consumers, like you were saying, and when you look in the 60s, we still had more. Now things have shifted, and really in a lot of ways, the civil rights movement was one of the worst things that happened to us, because integration took away everything. We don't have our stores or businesses or, you know, the way it used to be,
mm.
that impacted you on a local level. You know what
so,
I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. Are you suggesting that a separate but equal America would be better than an integrated America that has turned out to be relatively unequal and, well, actually, we're not all that integrated now?
Separate in the sense of, you know, when you look at other communities, the Jewish community, whoever, they have their own, but then they're integrated in the larger society. That's what I say with us. Obviously, you can't be totally segregated.
Yeah.
You know, but you can improve your own neighborhood, have your own businesses that serve your own communities, and then you work within the whole system. That's the answer. You know, I think history has shown, you know, you can't, you know, nothing is absolute. So you're going to have to look at the whole picture, just like all those statistics.
But doesn't, I understand what you're saying, Tony. Doesn't, though, having that as an explicit policy, and in some ways this is sort of what Malcolm X was talking about, if I remember my history right. Doesn't that then essentially give permission to whites to maintain their position of economic supremacy, essentially?
They're doing it anyway.
Well, okay, you got that.
I mean, really, honestly, I mean, you know, the whole kumbaya thing, what has it gotten us?
Yeah.
Nothing. We're still in the same shape. We're still at the bottom of everything. Education, healthcare, housing, everything. So all this, okay, I really want to, you know, integrate with you, has gotten us nowhere.
Yeah.
So my thing is, it's fine. Anybody want to work, I'm like Malcolm. Anybody that wants to work with me and we work together, great. If not, like you said, instead of begging, you know, when you're begging somebody for a human right that you have already, you're putting that person above you.
Yeah.
You know, when we're equal as human beings. So I don't have to ask anybody anything. I need to keep my money because, like you're saying, it's already like that.
Keep your money in your community. Keep your money with your people, basically.
There you go. And we work on whatever we got to do. Think about, all I'm saying is, as a business student, return on investment.
Yeah.
What have we gotten as a return on the investment that we've put in this country?
Yeah. Very interesting. Tony, thank you very much for your thoughts. Thank you for sharing that with me. I appreciate it. We'll be back. It is 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
What is the legacy of the life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Gail in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Gail. You wanted to talk about Sarah Palin and the Alaska Permanent Fund?
Yes. Sarah Palin was not responsible for that.
Oh, of course not.
That was done by Jay Hammond, who was governor when that went through, who set it up as something really beneficial to the citizens of Alaska.
Right. Do you know what party Jay Hammond was a member of?
I believe he was a Democrat. Most of the governors were while I lived up there.
Uh-huh.
I was raised in Alaska. And she just merely, like all the governors after it was enacted, just merely handed out the dividends to people.
Yeah.
But she had nothing to do with it. And you've said it several times, which is fine, but she really shouldn't be credited with it.
Yeah, I didn't mean to give her credit for, and thank you for pointing that out. I'll have to slightly calibrate what I'm saying in the future. I didn't mean to give Sarah Palin credit for the Alaska Permanent Fund as much as I wanted to point out to people that a Republican governor and one who's as far right wing as Sarah Palin, I mean, she could have theoretically argued against the Alaska Permanent Fund or said, you know, we're not going to pass this money out, but she was very pleased to pass that money out.
Well, sure, because it makes you look good.
Exactly.
And it's also part of the law. So she would have really had an uphill battle to fight if she decided not to. Because that's something that I don't live there anymore, but it's something people have depended on.
Yeah.
My niece went to college because her parents saved the money. And when she started college, that fund that they'd saved over the years for put her through college.
And, you know, a couple $1,000s a year and you add throughout the life of a child, and that would add up. But, yeah, that makes perfect sense. Gail, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for the you know, keeping me honest here. I appreciate it. Rolando in Granada Hills, California, watching Free Speech TV. What's up, Rolando?
Thank you for letting me speak to the people over there. Thank you very much, Tom. Sure. You have this collecting knowledge from all over the country and put that input to the people, you know. You mm-hmm. do a great job, and you are not only a radio commentator like you diminished yourself last time, you know. You are the best because you point that affecting the society here and all society affecting
thank you,
society.
Sir. Thank you.
The whole planet.
We have, I appreciate your kind words. We have just a minute left, though, and I want to hear what you have to say.
I want to say this. Martin Luther King saw the big picture. That's why he went to Vietnam, the injustice that we were inflicting those yeah. people over there, as well as the injustice here. So brothers, blacks, brothers from the Indian, they had to realize that we are human beings, and we have white people like you, Tom, mm-hmm. like Kennedy, that gave his life, you know, to trying to do better for the society, that his brother, that he gave his life, you know, Abraham Lincoln, who fighting for the slavery, abolished slavery too. We have white people that have been doing so much for humanity too. And when we segregate ourselves, you know, trying to put, then is when we have the games that the people in power want, like we start to fighting each other. We have to see each other as a human being, that we are really, because we have beautiful human beings for all over, like Martin Luther King, beautiful like Mahatma Gandhi, like you, Tom Hartman, that do so much work. So Einstein said, if we don't learn to live together as a human, we're going to die as a fool.
Yeah, it's a kind of a variation on Ben Franklin's, you know, if we don't stand together, we shall surely hang together, or hang separately, excuse me. Rolando, thank you very much for the call. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Frank in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Thanks, Tom. Martin Luther King Day means civil disobedience to me, mm-hmm. you know, change by any means necessary, and you know, also, I seem to remember something in my U.S. history lessons about equal rights and justice. Anyways, I was part of a protest movement in 99 to 2003 that shut down the 91 freeway for 10 minutes in Riverside, California to protest government and police abuse of power.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the local control by authority lost discharges, and I got sentenced to 75 days in jail, getting tortured by racist ISA guards and fighting with skinhead inmates. So if the law put me in jail for 75 days for a 10-minute shutdown, who's going to serve the time for the major interstate shutdown that lasted 4 days in New Jersey? You know, somebody's got to pay. These power-mad New Jersey fascists, and they can get away with terrorizing the children of Democratic voters on 9/11 for politics? Oh, somebody's got to pay, Tom.
Yeah, well, I have a feeling, Frank, somebody's going to pay. They've got some really, really big guns on this thing. Frank, thanks for sharing that story and for your activism. Michael, in Dublin, Virginia, you have thoughts on Martin Luther King's legacy?
Yes, Tom. I think that Martin Luther King's legacy is much that of JFK's legacy, which, by the way, as much as of a legacy as America's, as his common phrase is, we have a dream, the American dream also. But unfortunately, much of his legacy, much like the American dream, is slowly becoming only an American memory. You know, as other countries surpass us in education, healthcare, and economics and technology, you know, we should have an income. We should have it. I believe that everyone else, all Americans should have an income. But it's dependent on what American independence is. And unfortunately, again, we're becoming assimilated into a global dependent society where you find goods on your shelves made in other countries. The economics just don't add up. It would be great if we could all reinvest in America and spend our income in our communities as soon as we get it. But that's what we do. We spend it. We don't spend it in our community because it goes outside of our community. We spend it at the huge mega corporations, shopping centers, and supermarkets.
Well, it's even beyond that. It's as soon as you buy something in a store that was manufactured outside the United States, that money's actually leaving the country, not just the community. So it's like, you know, we've gone from tearing our communities apart to tearing our country apart. And, yeah, you know, because of these insane trade policies that we've got. But I'm with you, Michael. It's a very well said. Thank you very much. Gerald in Lake Wales, Florida. Hey, Gerald, what's up?
Tom Hartman.
Yep.
Martin Luther King, although small in stature, a giant among the greats, may have been assassinated for being against not only the Vietnam War, but the success that he could have accomplished to bring that war to an end early. Is probably a lot behind the actual killing.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree?
I genuinely don't know. Lamar Waldron is the guy who I would defer to on that, and because I know, you know, he was really looking into who was behind the funding for the assassination of Martin Luther King, and a lot of it went back to white racists in the South and in Atlanta specifically. And but I don't frankly remember the details well enough to speak beyond that. It's in Legacy of Secrecy, which is about the assassinations of JFK, RFK, and MLK. But Lamar really
more vocal, yeah, had he lived. Wouldn't you,
yeah,
agree?
Pardon?
He would have been more vocal against the Vietnam War had he lived.
Oh, he was very vocal against the Vietnam War as it was. I mean, that's the thing. People who are old enough to remember Martin Luther King know that this was a guy who stood in against the war in Vietnam in a very outspoken manner.
Oh, yeah.
Stood against the power of raw, unregulated capitalism in a very, very aggressive manner. Stood against, you know, the right-wing surveillance state and the police state in a very aggressive manner. And, you know, we've turned him into this kind of, you know, friendly, corporate-friendly icon, basically. And he was not at all corporate-friendly. He was, you know, very seriously a very severe critic of modern-day capitalism. So, Gerald, there may well be something to that. Thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, my favorite quote of MLK was, racial equality is meaningless in the face of economic inequality.
There you go.
And the fact that right now the Bank of Bahrain got a loan for 0.5% and students are paying 8.25% on their student loans, that's obscene.
Yeah.
So.
Well, we're lending money to Goldman Sachs. We're lending money to, you know, all these big banks at virtually nothing, and yet we're making a profit off student loans. And we shouldn't even have to have student loans. We should, you know, if we just took all the federal programs that are used right now to support for-profit schools and said all schools have to be nonprofit, and we're going to use that money to support state schools the way that Lincoln imagined it when he created the land-grant colleges, over 50 colleges across the United States. We could have free college education for everybody. I'm with you on that, Jeff. Thanks a lot for the call. Mark in Soap Lake, Washington. Mark, just a minute left. A real quick one.
Sure. Hi, Tom. After watching the hoopla in the Super Bowl yesterday and seeing Paul Allen becoming a local hero in Seattle, I was thinking his personal wealth is $30 billion. There's only 7 billion people in the world. He has enough money to give every man, woman, and earth on child $400. I think that might do
well,
a
no, it would be $4.
World poverty.
It would be $4.
$4?
Yeah. If he's got $30 billion and there's 7 billion people, that would be $4 each, wouldn't it?
Four
oh,
times
my seven.
God. Do I feel
yeah,
like an
it's 28.
Idiot.
Yeah,
but anyhow, he and a few other people could.
But I think that if we had a world without billionaires, we've got this site nobillionaires.com where we talk about this. That, you know, isn't $1 billion enough, and that we may have a good shot at doing away with a lot of the poverty in the world. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Good point. I mean, your math may be off, but your point is well taken. Very, very well taken. We'll be back. We're gonna talk about the white savior narrative in black films.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you, and we've been talking about Martin Luther King Day. Today, the holiday when we celebrate, memorialize, and consider the lessons of the life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Daniel Jose Older is on the line with us. He is a writer, editor, and composer and contributor over at Salon.com. His website is ghoststar.net, and he wrote this brilliant piece that I read it after I saw the movie, and I went back in my mind and kind of played the movie back and thought, oh, yeah. And the title of his piece is It's Time to Take the White Savior Out of Slavery Narratives. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm very honored to be here.
Thank you for joining us. So tell us what is this white savior narrative that we find so often in pop culture stories?
Yeah, I mean it's everywhere we look. I think it's particularly, I don't know if ironic is the word, but to see it so prominently in slavery narratives brings a whole other level to it, I think. But really, I mean I'm actually a science fiction writer, so that's my frame of reference. And of course, if you look at science fiction, it's a long history of basically white men, you know, saving things, saving the universe, saving the girl, all of these things.
That was Cameron's last movie. Avatar. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
White guy saves the indigenous people, basically.
Exactly. And I actually also wrote about Avatar and so on recently. That was a particular one where, if they had done the simple changeover and without changing any lines in the movie, had, for instance, the Latina who was in the movie, Michelle Rodriguez, I believe, cast as the main character, the movie would have had an entire new dimension of this idea of solidarity between folks of color on Earth and this indigenous, alien nation.
Right.
And all this other depth would have come out of that simple switch. But instead, we did the same old cliche. And yeah. I think the movie really suffered for it. And, it's an amazing movie, but again, we run into the same old.
Well, and in 12 Years a Slave, Brad Pitt, who helped produce it, by the way,
right,
suddenly pops up three quarters of the way through it, this white guy who has basically sold himself into indenture, as I recall.
Yeah, that's how it works. He pretty much shows up, and then he smuggles a letter out, admittedly at great risk to himself.
Now I have to say,
mechanism of freedom,
Daniel, about a month ago, a week or two before I saw the movie, I bought the book. I bought the e-book version of the book, and I started reading, and I'm maybe a third of the way through it. And I've just been reading it a couple pages every night before I fall asleep. I have not read the entire book yet. In fact, I haven't even read half of it. But I haven't found any white. Any character like Brad Pitt, was there a white guy who was like among the slaves in the book itself? Do you know?
My understanding is that he is based on the historical account, and there's been some pushback about that. People are saying, well, this is based on this guy's life and that's how it worked, so why would they do it differently?
Mm.
I think it's really important always to consider what narratives we privilege. So there's so many stories of black folks during slavery time taking freedom into their own hands. There's Harriet Tubman. There's the fellow I mentioned in the article, David Ruggles, who did these amazing, really just had an amazing life story. And where are these stories? They're documented. The Brooklyn Historical Society is doing an exhibit about abolitionism in Brooklyn. But why doesn't Hollywood take on these stories?
It's you talk about Lincoln and how, you know, Frederick Douglass was a powerful influence on Lincoln's life, and yet he was written out of the movie.
Completely. And again, the movie suffers for it, because then we have this character of Lincoln who, at the beginning of the movie, for no reason that we can understand, just wants to end slavery and is the exceptional white man in the narrative who just goes ahead and does this gigantic thing with no point of reference of to, you know, why that might be the case, what happened in his life that he would care about this so much. So, you know, we don't have a full idea of what really happened there, the narrative struggle.
Right. Do you think that the reason why, you know, why this is happening is because they're trying to, with these movies and books and things, but principally movies, that they're trying to reach a largely white audience, and without a white savior character, there's not a point of identification for a white audience?
You know, I think that's a part of it. I think a lot of it has to do with Hollywood and white America in general still being able to look full-faced at the history of slavery, at really the history of race in America, because it extends so much further than slavery. And I think it's really about an inability. I mean, I think marketing is part of it. I think it's also just a deeper inability to understand that there are times when there's no white savior, and there are many times. And they also are amazing stories, and those are stories we need to hear.
Yeah. You Django, same thing. You know, it's – there was
mm-hmm. – yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, where's the Harriet Tubman movie? You know, the last time Harriet Tubman was in the news, it was because someone was making fun of her sexually. You know, and that's an amazing American story of a black woman that did these incredible things. And it's – you know, we know her name, but – that would be an incredible movie, and we haven't seen it. And I would love to see it. I recently edited an anthology of speculative fiction from the margins of history. So it's called Long Hidden.
Well, if you, you write in a niche. You write science fiction. I'm a fan of science fiction, and I was a friend with Jack Vances for years and years. And you know, long story, but anyway. You know that when you're writing in a particular genre, that you know there are demands of that genre. There are demands of the niche. I mean, I can just see a bunch of guys sitting around in a production meeting. Oh, let's make a movie about Harriet Tubman. Who's the audience going to be? It's going to be a black audience, or is it going to be a white audience, or is it possible to make a movie that actually transcends, that crosses over, that brings both in?
Right. And what we're seeing, though, is that networks like Fox and ABC are starting to realize that when you have diverse programming, it actually makes a lot of money. And
like Scandal.
Scandal, Sleepy Hollow, these are what they call runaway hits, because no one saw it coming, because they figured that, okay, we'll cast a black character, black people will watch it, and that's it. And what's ended up happening is that tons of people watch it. They're having huge success with them. So Fox had this meeting where they said, you know, we need some diverse programming now that we realize that it's working.
Right.
We don't know what the real audience is for diverse programming, because it rarely gets the same amount of marketing that white programs get. So it's sort of anyone's guess, really. And what they're starting to see is that it actually has a huge marketability factor.
Yeah. Well, that's an important point. But even in Scandal, I mean, you know, the president's white, right? Is that a white savior figure, or actually he's kind of, you know, the crummy guy. I mean,
I can't stand Fitz. So to me, he's not a white savior character.
Yeah.
I love that that one thing that happens in Scandal is that the most powerful man in the world is trying to give it all up for a black woman. So there's,
you're talking about the female lead's father. Is that who you're talking about?
No, I mean the president is really trying to give up all his power so that he can be with Olivia.
Yeah.
Which is an amazing thing to see on TV. It's a complicated show, and I love it for that.
Yeah.
And there's all kinds of critiques launched at it from different ways. But and then you have that moment where Olivia's father just reads the president up, down, and left and right.
Yeah.
And that, to me, was this incredible moment to see on television, this black man telling a white man, who is, again, the most powerful white man in the world, the most powerful man in the world, that he's just a boy.
Yeah. Saying this, it's above your pay grade. You know,
right. I mean, what epic shutdown.
That was an amazing scene. So it is possible to do this. We don't have to have the whole white savior thing Of course,
we're better when we move past it.
Yeah, there you go. Very, very well said. Daniel Jose Older, a writer, editor, composer, contributor over at Salon.com. GhostStar.net is his website. Daniel, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Great talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. What is the legacy of Martin Luther King to you? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Scott in San Diego. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's a long time since I've tuned in or called. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard you or talked to you since KLSD.
Oh, my.
Progressive radio out here.
Yeah, that was so about 3-4 years ago.
Oh, at least, yeah.
Yeah.
About Dr. King's legacy, I'm 59 years old. I grew up in the D.C. area. I doubt that there's 1 in 100 people who could tell you what he was working on when he was called away to Memphis, where he was killed. And it was the Poor People's Campaign.
Right.
And in the summer of 68, a couple of months after he was killed, as a teenager, I went over for the Poor People's March, which he was supposed to lead, but obviously couldn't. And as far as his legacy, he's remembered, he's respected, but what he was working on at the time of his death was to dramatize through the Resurrection City project, kind of a plywood shanty town for poor people who would meet together at night, but in the daytime they would lobby and dramatize and bring about knowledge of the plight of poor people in this country. Now, that was 45 years ago. And we still got plenty of poor people.
Right.
And more and more, their situation is really being ignored. And a lot of people say, well, you know, Jesus said there'd always be poor people. Well, to me, there's two ways of approaching that. Those who don't want to do anything use that excuse from Jesus not to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But some people take that as a challenge and an invitation to do something. And I wish more people would do the latter as opposed to the former.
And I mean, back then we knew what that something was in two ways. I mean, there was the marching, the protesting, the being visible out there, and then there was the legislation that came about, you know, with the Great Society, pushing the government to say, okay, we're actually going to get involved. What do you see that movement as today?
Well, there's not much of a movement to speak of. I mean, there are groups and people who are aware of the situation and that...
But the NAACP is a shadow of what it was in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
There is no SNCC. There is no... The Christian Leadership Conference... Is it conference or council, the CLC? Martin Luther King's...
Southern Christian Leadership Conference.
Conference, right, yeah.
If Dr. King had not been killed, I think he would have done for poor people what he did for the situation of black people. And it was a natural progression.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was killed and so many cities went up in flames, and then the 70s happened, and then, God help us, the 80s happened.
And Reagan
came. And here we are today, and nobody seems to care.
Well, I don't think it's that nobody seems to care. I think it's that we've had our government captured in large part by a series of Supreme Court decisions in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and now today with Citizens United that all led up to this. Ever since, you know, 71 or 72 when Lewis Powell was put on the Supreme Court, saying that money is the same thing as speech, and it's allowed basically rich white people to take over our government. And everything just froze. It's like we've been like you know, a bug in that. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. won the Nobel Prize. And in December of 1964, he went to Oslo, Norway, to accept that prize. And here's a very short clip from the speech that he gave from the Nobel Peace Prizes website. Here it is.
I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up.
Wow. Wow. We can undo Reaganomics. I obviously, you know, Reagan came after Martin Luther King was assassinated, but, and in fact, I would say that the Reaganomics or the whole, you know, these 32 years of the Reagan era that we've been living in have, the metaphor I was using before is like a fly in amber, you know, have just kind of suspended things for 30 years. Suspended the middle class, average pay has not gone up, suspended racial separation and segregation, have suspended the black middle class, have suspended the, you know, poverty and among all races. These levels have not significantly changed since Reagan began deconstructing the Great Society. Dave in Batavia, Illinois. Hey, Dave. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi. Say, I've been inspired by the comments over the last half hour since I've been on hold, and I want to relate some of that to your question, which is, what is the legacy of King? First of all, you know, you spoke of the white savior in the most recent segment, but if we go back to Frederick Douglass in 1852, he spoke to a women's group in Rochester, New York, and July 5th, he refused to speak on July 4th because he said that was the white man's holiday and not his. And he spoke the black man and all people of concerned about justice should speak out loudly and not be try to be nice, you know, about justice.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that many of the people, I mean, the guy who wrote the Declaration was a slaveholder. Many of the people who promoted and fought the Revolutionary War were slaveholders. And
when we go to the 1960s of course, in my state, we had the Republican leader that you spoke of talking to Johnson, two white men sitting there, arbitrating what would be considered justice in that era. And we went on to 1967, April 4th, at the Riverside Church in New York, when Martin Luther King gave his first speech against the Vietnam War. And here we had him arguing for justice in terms of the black men sent over to a foreign land to support, the white man's hegemony in a foreign land. And 1 year to the day later, he was assassinated in Memphis on April 4th again. And that was not the Poor People's March, but that was, in fact, the speaking out for the rights of sanitation workers. And the signs that were held up were, "I am a man."
That's right. And the right, not just of sanitation workers, but of sanitation workers to unionize.
Yes.
If I'm remembering, I'm quite sure that that's the case. Yeah. Dave, excellent history. Thank you for calling and sharing that with us. Tom in Holyoke, Colorado. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, I just needed to correct, I respect the man in San Diego, but that statement that he quoted has caused so much poverty that I can't take it. Jesus did not say there will always have the poor among you. It is in the Baltimore Catechism, not the Bible.
Well, it's actually in the Bible, but you have to put it in context. What's her name? I think it was Mary Magdalene, was anointing his feet with perfume. and this was, and you know, they were just hanging around, right? Him and the disciples. And one of them, and I think it might have been Peter, said, it's been a long time since I read it, said, wait a minute, we should sell that perfume because it's worth a lot and give the money to the poor. And Jesus said, let her continue what she's doing. The poor you will have with you always. And he was not literally saying that's okay. What he was saying was, this is an important moment in history. You guys together with me, and she's doing something that is of consequence. I don't know what it was that was of consequence about it, and I suspect that there's a whole level, probably two or three levels of deeper meaning to that story that I don't understand, that I'd love to ask somebody like Elaine Pagels or Robert Funk, you know, so a genuine biblical scholar, Bill Moyer, somebody who might know, but it actually is in the Bible, and that's the story.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's where you'll find
is,
it. You know. But he was not saying that it was acceptable that you will always have the poor with you. What he was saying was, you know, don't tell me that, you know, she can't anoint my feet with this perfume. It's and the disciple, and as I said, I think it was Peter, said, you know, we should sell that money and give it to the, or sell that perfume instead of putting it on your feet, buddy, or excuse me, not buddy, master or teacher. It's one of those stories that I've always scratched my head about. And also, the Bible was, these stories were all written 100 years after Jesus was dead. And so you don't know how accurate they are, what got left out, you know, there's all kinds of questions there. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think it's interesting that it has worked, that phrase, though, has worked its way into the Catholic Catechism, if that's the case. I didn't grow up Catholic, so I don't know. That's fascinating. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very osmogoggly ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, Pamela Raintree, Shreveport, Louisiana resident, is drawing praise all around the country today for how she stood up to bigots on her hometown city council. In a recent hearing on whether or not to repeal Shreveport's new anti-discrimination law, Raintree, who is transgendered, called out Councilman Ron Webb for supporting the repeal efforts.
Leviticus 20:13 states, if a man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, they shall surely put him to death. I brought the first stone, Mr. Webb, in case that your Bible talk isn't just a smokescreen for personal prejudices.
Thanks to the hard work of Pamela and other activists, Shreveport's anti-discrimination law was upheld. In the end, bigotry was no match for the power of conviction and justice. The bad. Representative Mike Rogers. During an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday, the Michigan congressman and NSA fanboy went off on Edward Snowden, accusing him of having ties to foreign intelligence agencies.
Let me just say this. I believe there's... And he ended up in the hands, the loving arms of an FSB agent in Moscow. I don't think that's a coincidence, number one. Number two, and let me just talk about this.
You think the Russians
important.
Helped Ed Snowden?
I believe there's questions to be answered there. I don't think it was a gee whiz luck event that he ended up in Moscow under the handling of the FSB.
It's just amazing that Washington establishment politicians like Congressman Rogers are still trying to paint Snowden as the bad guy. After half a year of revelations have shown that people like Congressman Rogers have thrown the Fourth Amendment out the window. I guess when you've lost the battle for public opinion, the only thing left to do is to resort to ad hominem attacks and smear campaigns. And the very, very ugly Chris McDaniel. The Mississippi Senate candidate's past just keeps coming back to haunt him. Back in October, it was revealed that McDaniel spoke at a number of neo-Confederate conferences in his home state. And now Mother Jones has unearthed a clip of him complaining about the lack of Muslim villains in popular culture during a broadcast of his old radio show. Check it out.
You know, it's funny how the movies have portrayed themselves lately and how video games portrayed themselves lately. There's one person that cannot be a villain in Hollywood, ever. One group that cannot be villains. Who is that?
the Muslims.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Yeah.
They'll go out of their way to find some Russian white guy that's just nuts. But and he's the terrorist, which I've never seen that. But the Muslims, they've just disappeared from Hollywood's radar.
I don't know what movies or TV shows McDonald is watching. The last time I checked, stereotypical Muslim terrorists are all over the place in our culture. Has he ever heard of 24 or Homeland or Zero Dark 30? Look, Hollywood's stereotyping of Middle Eastern or Muslim men as evil terrorists is bad enough, but the fact that someone could actually want more racial caricatures, that is very, very ugly. He must be talking about the new Tom Clancy movie where the bad guys are Russian businessmen who are going to, they're basically trying to make a fortune off crashing the economy or some variation thereof. I thought that was very, very interesting. In any case, metaphor. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, you wanted to talk about the legacy of MLK?
Yeah, in a sense, I wanted to share this. I've been wanting to share this concept with you for a while, and it came up because of something I was reading. But I want to say, and also things I've heard today on the radio, I wanted to say that I think, unfortunately, Dr. Martin Luther King is becoming, in a sense, a reauthorized religious figure, in much the same way that. And let me tell you what I mean by that. Reauthorized is that. When people talk about Dr. Martin Luther King, I've been listening to the sort of the other side of the dial. They say this, when Dr. Martin Luther King said X, Y, Z, what he meant was, and then they interject their particular political viewpoint.
Right.
This is what bothers me when we talk about quoting the founding fathers, because it's a useless, and the same with the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
What Thomas Jefferson really meant when he said this was, and you go back and forth as to, we don't really know in a lot of ways what these people, we have their writings, but people try to reauthorize them to support their own point of view. And the same thing goes on with the Bible, even worse with the Bible, of course, because people take one verse out of a chapter and completely distorts the meaning of a particular, book of the Bible by taking one verse out of it. So it's reauthorized out of context. And I heard today, I was listening to a conservative station saying that, no, Dr. Martin Luther King, he really wouldn't support increasing the minimum wage because that would just take jobs away from young black kids. And I thought, oh, yeah, because really, we would prefer them to be in slavery. That's what this really means.
Yeah.
And, when you go back to, you're talking with your guest about the white savior of, what was the title of that? We mentioned that.
The title of it was, It's Time to Take the White Savior Out of Slavery Narratives.
Right. And this goes back to, there's a Christian writer by the name of Lee Strobel who's got a book called The Case for Christ. In chapter 7, where he talks about that slavery really isn't, it really isn't immoral, and he quotes Thomas Sowell, who says that the problem with American slavery is not that slavery is immoral; it's that it picked on one race. And I just thought, I got so furious, I had to email him and tell him I couldn't finish his blah 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 book, right?
Yeah.
And I put it to him in blah, blah, blah terms.
Right.
And he wrote back, and we had an email chat for a couple of times, and I just thought, I won't accept that.
Mm-hmm.
They also reauthorize history and say that, no, people in the Middle Ages sold themselves into history, and this is how we got serfdom, and that's absolutely false.
Yeah.
It's absolutely false.
No, people were born into those situations. And I would say that what's happened is that Dr. King has become Disney-fied.
Yeah, in its sense.
He's become acceptable to Disney, basically. The hard edges that he had, where he took on the establishment, he took on Richard Nixon, he took on the capitalism, he took on the rich, and in no uncertain terms, and, very, 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 very forcefully.
Right.
Virtually all of that stuff is gone to history now, other than anybody who, gone to the history of probably 95% of Americans.
Yeah, and if you think back, is that the conservative wing part of this country were all against having Martin Luther King Day.
Right.
But now that they couldn't suppress that, and now that we have it, well, if you can't beat them, let's join them, reauthorize it, and rebrand it as ours.
Yeah, I got it. I'm with you, Paul. Thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Cynthia in Chicago. Hey, Cynthia, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? You asked what was the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. I think one aspect of it, at least I think for many African Americans, even though people have fought throughout the history of country, I think it was to help them reduce their fear of daily terrorism in this country that they were exposed to sort of during this Jim Crow. I also think it shed a light internationally on American imperialism and also what was happening at home. So how could Americans be this moral authority in the world when you have a significant part of your population that couldn't participate? But also, he promoted peace. He pulled a number of civil rights groups together and sort of said, let's work and commit to nonviolence. Huge proponent of economic inequality. In fact, he felt that race and economic inequality, or racial inequality too, they were inseparable. But I also think, which we don't talk about, he sort of said we're part of the human race. So anything that's happening to African Americans is happening to everybody, not only in the United States, but worldwide, particularly after he won the Nobel Peace Prize and he just fought for peace. Another thing I wanted to say, I sort of think since the 80s, African Americans in this country are like the canaries in the coal mine.
Mm-hmm.
If something bad is happening with us in this country, when we're not working, it's affecting everyone in this country. And so as our opportunities have decreased, our inabilities to get jobs have decreased. Our inabilities, it's happening with everyone, and you see it particularly now.
Well, and it's sad to say, but as poverty and unemployment and cultural disasters move out of the African-American community into the white community in the form of poverty, unemployment, meth addiction, things like that, that's when all of a sudden it becomes a national issue, right? It's like when it starts happening to white people. And it's a shame that it has to go that way or that it has gone that way. But good end of it is that people are waking up.
Yeah.
And they're realizing that, hey, you know, we're all in the same boat. You know, we've all got, it was Grover Cleveland, in 1887, in his State of the Union address, President Grover Cleveland said, "Corporations, which should be the carefully restrained servants of the people, have become their masters. The iron heel of the corporate boot is upon the neck of the average man." And I mean, that people are getting it. So, Cynthia, thank you. Very, very, very insightful comment. Thank you for your call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Question is, you know, how are people going to respond to the damage that 32 years of Reaganomics has done in the white community? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Rick in Carrollton, Texas. Hey, Rick, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I was watching Democracy Now! Earlier this morning, and they were playing a couple of speeches from Martin Luther King. For years, I've known that he had the right thinking. I was on his side until I listened to these speeches this morning, and I went, wow, that was amazing. And what I started thinking of was, what is the end game of these rich people that are sucking up all the money and not providing all of this livelihood for the rest of the country? And one of the things I was just wondering from your perspective, that if you discuss this on air sometime, is how do you see that end game playing out? They suck up all the money, and then where does that leave everybody? I mean, it just seems like you guys would run some scenarios and just kind of play that through, because if, like, earlier I heard like 380 times the amount of money goes to the top. CEOs of the company and all right. that. Well, the people at the bottom, when you can't buy anything, they are the job creators. how do these people expect to keep going forward sucking all the money from the people that can actually buy the products?
Prior to the 1990s, rich people needed there to be a middle class in America, or at least something close to it. And because, you know, they needed somebody to buy their goods. But China now has a middle class that has over 300 million people in it. They had a middle class in the 1980s that had maybe 50 people in it. And now it's 300 million people. That's about the population of the entire United States. Our middle class is probably only 50 or 70 million people. You know, it may be 100 million people at the most. And then you've got, you know, kind of the working poor in between, and you've got a very, very tiny slice of the top percentage. You've got the Chinese middle class growing. You've got an Indian middle class growing. You've got a Brazilian middle class growing. You've got consumers in Europe. The people at the top of the economic ladder no longer need us. They no longer need an American consumer class, because they can sell outside the United States, particularly if they can get some more of these trade agreements going. And so, you know, they're perfectly happy to see the American middle class reduced to poverty and then, you know, shoved into debt and $1 trillion in student loan debt, you know, take away the money of the older people, you know, wipe them out with things like, you know, Medicaid, that if they have to go to a nursing home, they have to become impoverished first, wipe them out, steal their pensions, then wipe out the working class, wipe out, you know, people working in their 20s, 30s, 40s and 50s. By, you know, now the auto jobs start at $14 an hour instead of $35 an hour. And then you wipe out the young people with the student debts. You know, they're perfectly happy to see that happen, because they just don't need an American middle class anymore. And frankly, it's become a problem for them.
Well, if you take that timeline and run it out, where does it lead?
It leads to a very stable form of economy and society that Charles Dickens wrote about in A Christmas Carol, where you have a very small, super wealthy class, which he doesn't even touch in A Christmas Carol. You've got a very small middle class, the business owners, basically, which was Scrooge and Marley. And you've got a huge class of the working poor, the impoverished working poor, which is Bob Cratchit and his peers. And it's a very stable system. So that's what you've got, and that's what they're trying to get. It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. Sonia in North Highlands, California. Hey, Sonia, you were 7 when Martin Luther King was assassinated?
Yes, Mr. Hartman. I was sent home from school, and I cherish those memories. I'm 52 now. I remember them vividly. As I became an adult, I asked my mother about it, and she told me, I am a Hispanic woman from Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, we are part African-American. I learned slavery and racism in public school in textbooks, and it was until I came to the United States that I saw the textbook come up to life and the pictures and the pages come to life. And with racism, I could not live in white neighborhoods. There were streets that we could not cross as blacks and Hispanics in New York City. We were not allowed in certain neighborhoods. I learned about the eyes on the prize and the white and the colored water fountains. And I was absolutely, as a Hispanic woman, I was stunned. I was stunned to see this in this country. In Puerto Rico, if there is someone in the community with a racial issue, it was that person was frowned upon, because, again, we are part African-American. And it was just not acceptable to have a hint of a racial issue in Puerto Rico. When I came to this country, it was just very atrocious.
That's a fascinating perspective. Yeah. I've been to Puerto Rico, but I don't, you know, I just as a tourist, basically. So I have no sense of the Puerto Rican culture. But it makes perfect sense.
We are part African American, and our language was not originally Spanish.
Right.
Our language became Spanish because of Spain, but we had our own language, and we were natives in Puerto Rico. And again, we were forced to learn Spanish and to abandon our culture.
Right.
But the experience is very strong experience. The racial experience in this country is extremely disturbing.
It is. Fascinating story. Sonia, thank you for calling and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thomas in Flint, Michigan. Hey, Thomas, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to comment, too. First thing, shout out to Ed Schultz. he has been covering on ad nauseum the TPP. So one person in corporate media land has been.
Oh, good.
And it's been
good.
Ed Schultz.
Good on him.
I just wanted to let
Ed's
you know
Ed's a good
that.
Guy. He's a friend. He's a good guy.
Yeah, and he's been really good with that. And that's where my thing with Dr. King comes in, and citizen journalists, and the Kelly Thomas travesty that I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
During the Operation Fullerton not riot, the media did not report on it at all. Nobody did. There were a few streaming bloggers who were actually arrested for just streaming. They were literally...
What is this that you're talking about?
Operation Fullerton on Saturday. I'm surprised you don't know.
Me too. Tell me what I missed.
They protested at Kelly for Kelly Thomas at Kelly's Corner. No media. Al Jazeera didn't cover it. Nobody did. And
tell me the story of Kelly Thomas.
Kelly Thomas was the gentleman who was 37 who got beaten to death and tasered by the police in Fullerton.
Okay,
and
I know what you're talking about now. Yeah.
And they went to on Saturday to protest. It was peaceful. During the day, it was peaceful.
Right.
At night, apparently, Karen, the only story that I saw was about a camera woman getting slapped.
Mm-hmm.
When I was watching it, before they went dark on live stream, there were peaceful protests on my blog. Some say, and bro, I actually tie it all in. Mm-hmm. This is what they're trying to do, what you talk about, where Dr. King would be appalled about his dream being completely shattered by the corporations taking over the media. There was prison crap on MSNBC. I couldn't believe it.
Well, there always has been. I mean, you know, for a decade or more, they run that prison stuff at night.
But they weren't even, not a mention, not even like during the hour break or anything like that.
Yeah.
And for a station that prides itself in being so-called liberal, they are to a point. And
it's a business, it's like, Thomas. It's a business.
Yeah, exactly. But back to my original point, what upset me was there was a journalist, citizen journalist, who got arrested named PM Bears.
Mm-hmm.
She was streaming, and she made a comment. She was like, I can't find a friend of mine. I don't want to be arrested. But she continued streaming until her stream went dark.
Wow.
And then the whole internet, Twitter, got the anonymous groups were tweeting that she got arrested.
Right. Do you don't know what happened to her?
Well, the last I heard of it Saturday was that she had like a $500 bail.
I see.
And I don't know anything beyond that.
Yeah.
But this is appalling. And this is what, there are people protesting, but nobody, the blackout, I mean, I'm shocked that you didn't hear about it.
Yeah.
You're like my go-to guy.
Yeah. Well, Thomas, thank you for, you know, you just shared it with millions of people. Thank you for doing that. And thank you for reminding me of it. And, you know, I appreciate it. Thank you. Brian in Denver, listening on KKZN. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Regarding Martin Luther King, I have read that after he started protesting the Vietnam War, that Lyndon Johnson, the president at the time, then started referring to the Reverend King as that N-word preacher, using the N-word, which we know what that is.
Yeah.
Further, I think it was late last year that the Supreme Court very much curtailed the Voting Rights Act. I believe it was in that time frame.
Yeah, they got it.
And Clarence Thomas said something to the effect, I believe, that racism was not so much of a problem in this country anymore. And not too long after that, Clarence Thomas's nephew was arrested somewhere in the South and either strip searched and or tasered. And he was up in arms about that. So I thought that was a nice ironic touch. Now, regarding Harriet Tubman, Cicely Tyson did a movie or a TV thing, and she played Harriet Tubman. I don't know if it was all about only about Harriet Tubman.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. Thanks for the heads up on that, Brian. I'll have to track that down. And thank you for the call. We'll be back. It is coming up on the top of the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour. We've been talking about Martin Luther King, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and what his legacy is to this day, how he has been in so many ways for so many Americans, particularly white Americans, Disneyfied, his outspoken confrontation of the military-industrial complex, his passionate argument against the war in Vietnam, his support for poor white people as well as black people, the day he was killed, he was working to unionize sanitation workers, that he had just come from the March for Poor People, the Organization for the Poor, and just all of this has been turned into, he had a dream that one day little black kids and little white kids would hold hands. And isn't that what we're doing now? Well, not so much. And what we did see was both black and white poverty in the United States decline substantially in the 1960s as a result of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. And in the 1970s, over about a 10-12-year period, we saw poverty in the United States almost cut in half. And then Reagan came along, and poverty, black poverty in the United States is pretty much right now where it was then. It just froze everything, just like white income froze at that level. It's like it's been right across the board. So, but it goes beyond that. It's like slavery is this original sin, this cancer at the core of American society that we just don't confront enough. You know, what brought us to these kinds of things? What led to Dred Scott? What led to separate but equal? What led to Jim Crow? What is leading today to this basically white racist Southern conservative movement? Anyhow, Noah Berlatsky is with us. Noah wrote a piece for Salon. Was it Salon or Slate?
It was for The Atlantic.
Oh, The Atlantic. There it is. Hey, Noah. Thank you for. I've got it right in front of me, and it took me a minute to find the Atlantic logo on it. Titled, What Movies About Slavery Teach Us About Race Relations Today? And Noah, first of all, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. We had earlier in the program, an hour ago or so ago, Daniel Jose Older on, who had written the book or written the piece for, I think it was Salon, that said it's time to take the white savior out of slavery narratives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You referenced that in your piece, but you have some really specific thoughts about slavery and the way it's presented in popular culture. You want to riff on this a bit?
Sure. I can talk about it a little. I think that there's been a couple of high profile slavery movies, especially recently. With
Django and 12 Years a Slave.
And Django, right. You know, which I think is important in a lot of ways. I mean, I think Daniel has a. I mean, I think it's true that the most high profile ones, the narrative that we tend to be most comfortable with, is a story about, first of all, about, which is about, you know, I mean, black people suffer and at the hands of white people, and then as Daniel said at the end of it, some good white people or other, you know, they save people.
Right.
Which
I mean, happens sometimes, but it's like...
It happened to some degree. Yeah. I mean, you know, that white people were the ones with power, and white, you know, there was this big war about slavery in which lots of white people died. But, you know, I feel like it would be... You know, there are other stories to tell, too. I mean, just mm-hmm. in the first place, you know, not all stories about slavery end happily.
Right?
I mean, not all Holocaust stories have to end happily, right? I mean,
right.
You know...
How do you pronounce it? Is it Sankofa, the movie that you're writing about here?
I think so. I think that's how you pronounce it. Yes, Sankofa. Right. And that's a story. That was a 1993 film, which didn't get a lot of distribution. But mm-hmm.
I confess I have not seen it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's hard to get copies. It's not around very much. Mm-hmm. But it's a time travel story, and it's basically about this woman who is an American model, and she's doing a shoot.
She's an African American model.
She's an African-American model, that's correct. Mm-hmm. And she's doing a shoot in Ghana, I believe, and she sort of travels back to the past and ends up as a slave on a plantation. And so it's, I mean, it's basically about the fact that slavery is still very present, mm-hmm. right? So it's not really a story. It's like the story doesn't work. I mean, Kindred, which is by... Octavia Butler, which is a novel by Octavia Butler, works in a similar way. It's a time travel story. So you don't really, it doesn't really work in terms of, like, it isn't that there are black people who are oppressed and then eventually white people free them. It's more like there was this trauma that happened, right? And people still, it still pulls at people. It still has this grip on the present.
Yeah.
So
you noted in your critique of, or your, I don't know if critique is the right word, but in your narrative about Sankofa, that when she comes back to the present, she sees the white photographer who is shooting her because she's a fashion model as an oppressor suddenly. I mean, her perspective on him completely changes as a result of this experience.
She sees him as being part of a power structure, which is continuous. With the past, because when she goes back into the past, she's as a slave, she's raped repeatedly. She's getting raped, and so that's sort of. And there's.
It seems that you know I had this conversation a week or two ago with Andy Schlall, a fellow here in Washington D.C. who's running for mayor, and he said, you know, we need to be talking about race more in the United States. He said white people tend not to talk about race. Black people tend to talk about race a lot. And Andy is, he's actually an Iraqi immigrant who is usually taken by African-Americans to be African-American and sometimes taken by whites to be Middle Eastern or you know, something not African-American.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's had both experiences, and he came to the United States at the age of 10. And it's like, if the thing that defines you first and foremost is the color of your skin, then it makes sense that you would talk about that a lot, that that would become the center of your world. And whites have basically, you know, white privilege and power in this society, and so the color of their skin doesn't define them in a way that they're conscious of. You know, it's sort of like fish in water. They're not conscious of the water. Whereas for African Americans, the color of their skin does define them. You know, every encounter with the police, everything. And he owns a restaurant here in town, Bus Boys and Poets, and he was talking about how he tells his waiters, his wait staff, you know, if you've got an empty room and a white couple comes in and there's a, you know, an empty chair, an empty table over by the window away from everybody, they will like that, you know. Whereas if a black couple comes in and you put them there, they're going to think, oh, I'm being separated from everybody else. It's like there's these different worldviews. It's pretty amazing stuff.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, and I mean, I think, one of the things that's interesting about Sankofa is that it's
I mean, it's pretty anti-white.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, I mean, in a pretty straightforward way. I mean, an anti-Christian.
Yeah.
Because Christianity
was used to justify oppression, to justify slavery.
Right. Which you get in 12 years, but even more than that, it's kind of, I mean, which in 12 years a slave, they sort of present that,
mm-hmm.
you know, that the hypocrisy of, right. of the way Christianity was used. But in Sankofa, it's even more like, being connected to African religion is, you know, part of resistance and part of what is being undermined by whiteness. So I'm like, I don't feel like that's the only story that should be told in terms of slavery narratives, but I feel like, you know, having alternatives.
It's good stuff.
A good thing. Yeah.
Noah Berlatsky, the piece is called What Movies About Slavery Teach Us About Race Relations Today.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Noah, thanks so much for being with us. TheAtlantic.com is the website. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks. It would be interesting if we reached a point where whites talked about race more and blacks felt the need to talk about race less. It would be very interesting. Bruce in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Not much, Tom. I hope you're well. You know, everybody listened to these speeches by Martin Luther King, but there was a bunch of them they didn't listen to. And there was a subject called 40 Acres and a Mule, and all these conservatives say blacks should not get reparations. I'm not really sure where I stand on that, but he actually spoke of the fact that white European immigrants who were young men lined up on the Oklahoma border, and they had a land rush to give these white Europeans for their 40 acres and a mule. But the black slaves never got that.
Right.
And
it wasn't just the Oklahoma border. It was the Atlantic seacoast. I mean, you know, the white Europeans discovered a country that was already fully occupied.
Correct. You know, correct as well. You know, and that's if you listen to all of Martin Luther King's speeches, you know, you'll understand that he was more than just race. It was about equality for all people. Also, you talk about 12 Years a Slave. Do you know the actor named Avery Brooks by any chance?
I don't.
Anyway, he did a movie called Solomon Northrup well before this movie was out. It's the same thing. It was the same character or whatever. And he also played that role as well.
Oh, interesting.
So it's kind of a deal where, you know, we get reminded of what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You can't live in the past. However, though, you're reminded of the past and back to when you group everything together and you realize that the things that happened in the 80s were things that were trying to take us back to the past with Reagan and all the things we tried to repeal.
Yeah. Well, that was what the 80s was all about, was undoing the 60s, basically.
Yeah.
You know, let's reverse the women's rights movement. Let's reverse the civil rights movement. Let's reverse the beginning of the gay rights movement. Stonewall happened in 69, if my recollection is correct. Let's reverse the young people's rights movement. You know, it was in 72 that young people got the right to vote, written into the Constitution as a consequence of the Vietnam War. Let's just reverse all this stuff and go back to a time when basically, you know, white males control everything.
Yeah, and what's sad about that is I work with some people that they think the particular person I'm talking about was recalling the old Archie Bunker song, you know, way back when we didn't need any welfare states.
Right.
That is a time that never existed.
That's
people
right.
Romanticize about something that never was.
Yeah. No, the first president to authorize federal funds to care for feeding, housing, clothing, and providing medical services to poor people, the first president to do that was George Washington.
Absolutely.
We had a poorhouse here in Washington, D.C. We've always had a welfare state in the United States. It's just that, you know,
the thing that people forget, they have co-opted the right that is religious. And from what I understand is you're supposed to feed the poor, you know, clothe the naked, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there's no compassion anymore.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I'm totally with you. I mean, this is Matthew 25. It's almost like conservatives are reading a different Bible. It's pretty amazing. Bruce, thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to KBCS. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. did you catch where the President of the United States said pot is less dangerous than alcohol? Now, he was the third president in a row to have smoked pot, although Bill Clinton did not inhale. Right. If you believe that, I've got a international trade treaty to sell you. But he came out and he said it. I think it's the beginning of a new awakening here in the United States. I wish people would awaken also to what's going on with Governor Don Siegelman. To digress slightly, Karl Rove's personal political prisoner is still in prison. And you need to go to free-don.org to learn about that story. It's pretty amazing. So, anyhow, it's 20 minutes past the hour, and Marcia in Smyrna, Georgia. Hey, Marcia, your parents helped arrange an integrated dinner for Martin Luther King, really?
Yeah, after the Peace Prize.
Uh-huh.
After he got the Peace Prize, my father, who was a prominent minister rabbi in Atlanta, convinced the city that if they didn't do something, they were going to lose their place in history and be thought of, you know, they had a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Right.
They needed to do something. So he got some others together and arranged the dinner that the city gave to Martin Luther King. And while he was at it, my mom said to him, well, you know, the city ought to give him something. So he goes and says to the mayor, my wife says, the city ought to give him something. He says, okay, fine. He comes home and he says, that's a great idea. You arrange it.
What?
So she got on the phone and drew a dogwood blossom design on the back of an envelope and got on the phone a couple of times talking directly to Steuben. And it was right after the Christmas break, and their guys get vacation after the Christmas rush.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't, you know. And the person she was talking to said, well, I'll ask him and get back to you.
Are you talking about Steuben the Glass Company?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a bowl that was given. It's at the King Center.
Right.
And he came back to her a couple of days later and said, not only will they come back and do it, but they'll do it for half of what I quoted you.
Wow. Sweet.
So,
did you meet Dr. King?
Yeah, well, he came to dinner in my house once. I was 16, and I grew up with a father who was, you know, children should be seen and not heard.
Right.
So we came in, we shook hands, we got lost, my brother and I.
Yeah.
But
what was your sense of
it? We did go to the dinner, and my mother did some work with and was very close with Mrs. King until she died.
Wow. What was your sense of him?
Well, you know, like I say, I was a kid. I had the same sense of him from the media, but I can tell you this. I was in college. I was a junior in college in New England when he was assassinated, and the immediate feeling I had was I was ashamed.
Yeah.
I did not know what to say. I didn't want to go out of the building.
Yeah.
I was so ashamed for my people.
Yeah, I understand. I understand.
So, but it was an interesting childhood I had.
I can imagine. Marcia, thank you for calling and sharing the story with us from Smyrna, Georgia. I appreciate it. James in Santa Fe Springs, California. Hey, James. Social Security
Tom.
And Medicare? I'm fine.
Hey, Tom. Are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, sometimes I can't tell. You know, I was, you know, the one thing I have in common with Martin Luther King, we were born in the same year. He was born in January. I was born in November.
Uh-huh.
And you know, one thing was that I'm Irish, and my people, my ancestors went north and turned white, and his stayed in Africa and stayed black. But other than that, we're all one race. There's no Caucasian, all that crap they tell you anyway.
Yeah, there's no gene for race. There are genes, individual genes for the color of your skin or the color of your hair or, you know, whatever, but there is no gene for race. You're right. We're all Homo sapiens. We are all the same species.
We all originated in one space, and that was in Africa. And
in all probability, yeah. Yeah. So is that what you wanted to call and tell me?
Yeah, well, I'm very concerned about voting, and I'm very concerned about Medicare for all, and I'm very concerned about Social Security being, you know, like what? Well, you pay enough into Social Security, you'd end up about $3,000 a month after when you retire, instead of whatever it is now.
Right.
because, you know, because it would take it all out of the hands of these corporations, and all they would do is you'd work for them, and you'd pay your part, and they'd pay their part, and then they wouldn't have any excuse for it. And, you know, all this business about health care and everything else.
Right.
Another concern, I know this, I'm trying to jam a lot in here. The other concern of mine is that everybody should vote.
Yeah.
We should.
I absolutely agree with you, James, and thank you for your call. We do need to strengthen our social safety net systems, number one, and number two, we need to figure out ways to get everybody to vote. In Australia, they actually give you the equivalent of a parking ticket if you don't vote. You know, it's like $25 the first time and then $100 the second time, and it starts racking up, and they get over 95% of the people vote there. I think there's something to that. Don in Pinkerton, Ohio. Hey, Don, you wanted to talk about Martin Luther King?
Yes, and particularly two things. I wanted to highly recommend your book, The Christ of 2016.
Well, thank you.
Because of that book, I am a monthly giver to the Move to Amend.
Oh, great.
A terrible decision that that our Supreme Court did to us.
Yeah, that's
corporations, people, and making money voice rights, which is crazy.
Well, that's great, because the woman who runs Move to Amend is going to be on our program in 20 minutes.
Yeah. Okay. Also, along with that, on their website, Move to Amend, there's a good quote from Dr. King. Mm-hmm. And I think it's apropos to the book that you've written and the situation that we're in with our freedoms being.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds. You want to share it with us quickly?
Okay, yes. Dr. King said, freedom is never given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed.
Yes.
And I think we as the oppressed, we have to stand up and give the royalists their due guard.
I'm with you. Don, thank you for the kind words about my new book, and thank you for the call, and good on you for supporting MoveToAmend.org. As you know, I have no affiliation with the organization, official, unofficial, other than I know the people who started it, and I have tremendous respect for them. But they're we're going to have Caitlin on the program here in another 20 minutes. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But I really think this is what will save America, is for us to overturn that Supreme Court decision and say money is not speech. It's your media support group for we the people of the United States of America, of the planet, right? People of the planet. All life on planet Earth. All life in the galaxy, all life in the universe. It's the biggest picture possible, right? John in Vashon, Washington. Hey, John. Isn't it Vashon Island?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's up?
Oh, thanks for taking my phone call. I've been listening for a long time, and ever since you've been in Portland, and this is a big thrill, so thank you for taking my phone call. I wanted to talk about restitution,
mm-hmm.
because I think...
For slavery?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if you look at the history of the United States, our power is really based on the economic engine that got started with slavery. And until we come to terms with that as a nation, we're never going to be able to come to terms with taking care of poor people or a decent minimum wage, health care for everyone. When I hear certain people on the right wing talk about, when they're justifying their views for why we should not even have a minimum wage, I think back to earlier arguments when slave owners that had plantations would actually, you know, say that they were taking care of black people because they couldn't take care of themselves, that sort of thing. I just wonder what your thoughts are on restitution. I know it's probably not going to ever happen in our lifetime, but I think it would create so much healing in this country if we did do it.
I think that, you start, if we were to do something like that, then you start getting into those very, very sticky wicket problems like Native Americans have on the res, where... one person qualifies for a card, for a BIA card, Bureau of Indian Affairs card, because they can demonstrate a certain percentage of Indian blood ancestry, and another person who might have grown up next door to them and thinks of themselves as a member of that reservation doesn't qualify. Or, somebody in the city who's never had any association with the culture or the reservation does qualify. You know what I'm talking about here?
I think
that rather than saying we're going to do restitution for slavery based on somebody's racial past when they may have a very, very, you know, I mean, a very mixed racial past, we are increasingly a nation of mutts, a polyglot culture. I think instead we need to be dealing with the issues of poverty and class. And if we could solve in America the issues of poverty and class, that would resolve the issue of race. Because I see race as a subset of class. Our society, we've always been a slaveholding society. Western society, from its start in Sumeria 7,000 years ago, was always a slaveholding society. It's just taken many, many different forms over the years. And it's always been based on an economic system, economic slavery. And, regardless of race. And, you had white people who were sold into indenture. Or you could argue that people working on the mines in West Virginia, 100 years ago, who tried to rise up in the early strike days, that functionally they were, slaves. They ended up owing the company store more than they earned, that kind of thing, that really what we need to do is deal with these issues of class and poverty. And if race has been one of the, because you can see a person's race, it's been one of the easy ways to say, okay, we're going to take a certain segment of the population and they're going to be poor in order for us to have this society where, this class strata society. And if we did away with the class strata, if we fixed that, then I think the issues of race would resolve themselves quite quickly. Am I making sense here, John?
Yeah, I think you are. And I think that's perfect.
And I think that's what Lyndon Johnson was trying to do in the 60s, because he was, and frankly, I think it's what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King was trying to do in the 1960s as well, because both of them were talking about poor white kids in Appalachia nearly as much as they were talking about poor black kids all over the United States. And so, we really need to be addressing poverty as well as race, obviously, and racism. But also, I think that as the old racist whites are dying out and this new younger generation is coming up that doesn't so much see race, really gets it about class, that's the new divisor. The new line of cleavage is now class rather than race. And in fact, if you want to look at popular culture, if you want to look at movies, like the movie Scandal, where you've got a black woman having an affair with a white president of the United States, but they're both from the same class, and there's still, you don't see poor people in that show. And because poor people, it used to be poor black people, but now I'd say it's just poor people in general, tend to be the untouchables in our culture. They tend to be the ones that aren't talked about. Poverty is not discussed. Issues of class are not discussed, and that's really where we need to go. John, thanks a lot for the call. Jerry in Eureka, California. Hey, Jerry, you want to disagree with me on something here?
Oh, that was way beyond that, Tom. All you liberals remind me of, like I said, an optometrist trying to adjust the vision of the dinosaur. He's dead. It's over. Look around.
Okay.
It's over. And America, as you know it and as you believe it to be, no longer exists. You must live in a bubble. But I suggest you get out on the streets. Try L.A., where they got about 80,000 homeless living in downtown. Look around. Sooner or later, it's going to reach critical mass. And then what are you going to do then when it reaches critical mass, when the people have no other alternative but to revolt?
Well, then I think that you're going to see some real significant change in this country. And my hope is, and this is, I talk about this in my book, The Crash of 2016. My hope is that...
You're always selling your books, too. I mean, haven't you got enough money? I mean, my God.
I put several of my books up for free over at truthout.org. I mean, this is not about trying to sell a book. the point that I was making is that we can go one of two ways. When the crash of 20, and the reason why I said the crash of 16 is because when the crash of 1932 happened, or the crash of 1929, when that happened, it hit Germany as well as the United States. And Germany had Hitler and we had FDR, and the outcomes were very different. And so when this next crash, what you're talking about, Jerry, happens, it's going to, you know, a lot is going to depend on who is politically active, not just who's in power, but who's politically active and who's gone to sleep. And that's why we need to stay politically active, respectfully. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan.
I have a couple things about the legacy of Martin Luther King and the civil rights struggle in general. I think we moved on, you know, even though the struggle for equality wasn't really over, and, you know, not just in regard to race, but gender and otherwise.
Right.
And
Women are still earning 73% of what men are earning. I mean, you know, it's...
Correct. And then I have an anecdote about when you were talking about white privilege and how whites sometimes don't really see things or understand it.
Right.
Back around, I think it was the early 90s, but before apartheid ended, a friend and I, a coworker, went to a restaurant for lunch, and you notice that the owner or manager had kind of an odd accent, sort of British or German. And then he also talked to some of the employees who I think were Algerian, talked to them in French, and friend got kind of curious, asked him what his nationality was, and he said South African. And the friend, there was like a slight pause and kind of went, oh. So as we were walking back to the car, my friend, who's white, I'm black, and he says, well, can you imagine what that would be like, you know, like when you meet people and they're kind of suspicious, wondering whether you're one of the good guys or the bad guys, and I said, yeah, and I didn't think of it, you know, until later. Well, yeah, I know what it's like, you know, as a black person, you're kind of under suspicion, you know, and but, you know, it also struck me that my friend, you know, like, he could see that, you know, that point with a white South African, but probably didn't see it, that blacks undergo the same thing.
Here in the United States, at the hands of whites. Yeah.
Yeah, and I have one last quick anecdote. The caller earlier from Puerto Rico reminded me of my first experience with segregation. I'm from the U.S. Virgin Islands, and so kind of a similar background, hadn't really experienced segregation.
Right.
And we moved to Georgia because my dad was in the Army, and I was five, ready to start.
Dan, just a heads up, we got 40 seconds here to finish.
Yeah, I'll be done with it. I couldn't read very well. But colored and white were two of the words that I learned to recognize early on.
Wow.
That's my experience.
Wow. And the Virgin Islands were not racially segregated?
No, not officially, you know, by class there probably was, you know, in terms of...
But not by law, like it was here in the United States.
No.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that, you know, just in my lifetime that we've seen these changes. It's just amazing. Dan, thanks for calling and thanks for sharing those stories. It's great. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us in San Diego. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Martin Luther King, a democratic socialist? Could be. And welcome back. Umberto in Hialeah, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Umberto, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm glad I got through, especially at this late hour. Basically, what I wanted to say and comment on is I do remember reading the autobiography of, well, the biography of Dr. Martin Luther King. And in one of the interviews that he gave, while he was in jail in Birmingham, Alabama, was a commentary where he said that if this country really wanted to move forward in the direction that it has to be more equal society, a more just society, it would have to seriously consider moving in the direction of democratic socialism. He actually used those two words, democratic socialism. I have been a democratic socialist myself since age 19. I'm 42 now. And I can tell you that unless we as a nation are able to shrug off, literally shake off this really almost demagogic fear of the word socialist and of anything having to do with socialism, even the more democratic type of it, we're not going to make the kind of progress that we want to make politically, socially, or economically. Because let me tell you, I support the progressive left wing of the Democratic Party, but I do believe myself that there's going to come a point in this country where progressivism alone is not going to be enough to move forward. We have to seriously consider democratic socialism and what it proposes to do socially and economically. I encourage people to go on the internet and look up democratic socialism, read up on it, and seriously consider it. And one last thing, I personally believe that a lot of people in this country who call themselves progressives have actually moved on in their way of thinking towards what could be called democratic socialism.
I agree.
Thanks a lot.
I agree. Umberto, thank you very much. I'm totally with you. I call myself a democratic socialist. Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist. I think it's just fine to say that. I've got no problem with that at all. Tim in Leesburg, New Jersey. Secession petitions, Tim, in New Jersey?
Yeah. You don't remember hearing about that on the news?
Well, I know that, I hear about them from time to time and place to place. I didn't realize it was happening in New Jersey.
No. I'm talking about when the president won the 2012 election.
Right.
A bunch of Republican states, the ones that changed their voting laws so this way minorities couldn't vote so they can get their guy to win.
Right.
Well, these places also, after they found out the president won, I saw on TV and on the internet for a few days, a bunch of states, it was like 17, 20-something states, signed these petitions to secede from the United States.
Right.
Or something like that. I saw it on the news, I looked on the internet. Now, the problem with today is it's hard to differentiate the difference between reality.
Yeah, I can tell you no state legislature has authorized secession. There is no state. But you do have these, wackadoodle politicians on the far fringe right who are talking, and some on the left, actually. In Vermont, there's a left-wing secessionist movement that wants to, reinvent the Democratic Republic of Vermont. So, but Tim, thanks for the call. Yeah, it's racism does still exist in our country. President Obama finally spoke out about that. I'm sure he's getting excoriated by the right on talk radio for it right now. But it just came out in a magazine interview, I think, just today, 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Well, you heard us talking earlier about, we've got to get money under control here. And the doctrine that the Supreme Court has promulgated that money is somehow the same thing as speech is nuts. The people who are doing something about it, movetoamend.org. And Caitlin Saposi-Belknap is with us, the national director of the Move to Amend Coalition. Caitlin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Happy Martin Luther King Day.
Thank you. Happy Martin Luther King Day to you, too. So tell me, what is Move to Amend up to right now?
Well, we're definitely still in the education and mobilization phase of this movement. As you talk about on your show fairly often, most of the American public agrees with us, but they don't necessarily know that there's anything happening to make it clear that corporations don't have the same rights as people and money is not speech. So we need to get people involved in this movement. And I'm excited about what we'll be doing tomorrow, which is unfortunately the fourth anniversary, 4 years since Citizens United. But we're using that opportunity to continue to bring in more folks and get the word out on Free Speech TV.
And what is it that you're doing?
Well, we're partnering with Free Speech TV for a whole evening of information and education. We'll be showing they'll be showing our film Legalize Democracy, which is a 30-minute film that we put together with filmmaker Dennis Traynor, all about Move to Amend and why we have to amend the Constitution and how people can get involved. And then I'll be doing a quick interview, and Dennis will be doing a quick spot, and folks from Represent Us will be on as well. And then at 10 p.m. Eastern Time is another segment that we put together. One of our very eloquent speakers, Ashley Sanders, she gave a speech in Seattle last year that was filmed and taped and put on for Pirate TV in Washington State, so that will show as well. So that's all tomorrow night. If folks have Free Speech TV, you can tune in on your television, but you can also watch it live on freespeech.org.
Yeah, that is great. And we're talking with Caitlin Saposi-Belknap, the National Director of the Move to Amend Coalition. MoveToAmend.org is the website. I've not seen this movie yet. Is there any way to see it without, you know, if you're not going to be around to watch Free Speech TV tomorrow night?
We haven't put it up on YouTube yet. You can get the DVD from us if you go to our website, which you just gave, MoveToAmend.org. There's some images that flash across the front page, and one of them is information about how to get the DVD and watch it in your own home. And with this, after this premiere, this is kind of the world premiere of the show,
uh-huh.
of the film on Free Speech TV. But after that, we'll be putting it on YouTube to make it available for everyone. And
that is
you're
great.
In it, Tom, so you should check it out sometime.
I'm in it?
You're in it.
Oh, my. Okay.
Yeah, when we when Dennis was in Washington, D.C. For the introduction of our amendment in Congress by Congressman Rick Nolan and Mark Pocan in February of 2013, he did a quick interview with you since he was in the neighborhood, and that segment made it into the film.
Oh, I'm honored. I'm honored. Now I definitely want to see it. So that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern Time?
It's 9 o'clock Eastern Time is when it kicks off, and there's a live stream on the front page of our site, and if folks go to freespeech.org, and then, of course, if they're watching your show on TV now, that means they have it, and they can just tune in live. And also, the video will show several more times over the week on Free Speech TV, so folks should check their listings because there's several different opportunities.
That is great. Give me an update. You know, what is going on with the Move to Amend Coalition? How close are we to amending the Constitution to say that corporations should not have the rights of persons under the 14th Amendment and that money should not be considered speech protected by the First Amendment?
Well, it depends how you look at it. I mean, in terms of, Congress, I would say we're not that close. Congress isn't really moving on this. In terms of activity in the states and at the grassroots level, there's a lot of momentum building. 16 states have passed resolutions calling for Congress to send an amendment to the states for ratification. We have folks in Washington State who are gearing up to start collecting signatures for a state ballot initiative this year. Folks in Oregon are looking to do something similar either this year or in 2016. We have folks all over Wisconsin who will have it on the ballot come November this year, same with California and many different counties. And so what we expected is that we would need to build this movement from the bottom up, and that's what we're doing. So we have, you know, over 500 communities that have said, Congress, you need to move this forward. And then we can use that as leverage to get our representatives to pay attention. And ultimately, if they won't pay attention to us, then we need to make this a political issue in elections. And this is a federal election year, so we'll be gearing up our Pledge to Amend campaign, where we speak to people who are in office now and let them know that if they want to stay there, they need to support our campaign, and also people who are running for office, whether it's federal, state, or even local office, because the people who are running for city council now will be likely the folks who are on state legislatures, you know, in 4 or 5 years. And so we need to be targeting every level of the political process to make this the issue that is necessary to be on our side if you want to get reelected.
That is great. We just have 30 seconds left. Caitlin, a quick question. Do you know if anybody is taking on the issue of judicial supremacy?
I think that there's a lot of discussion about that, but there's not a campaign yet. I mean, part of what we want to spark with Move to Amend is deeper questions about how we could make our country more democratic in other ways as well. And certainly having the Supreme Court able to overturn democratically enacted laws meant to protect the people is a big issue. And
yeah,
so,
I was talking with a publisher last...
about that, engage with Move to Amend.
Yeah, there you go. MoveToAmend.org. Check it out, and tomorrow night, freespeech.org, and or if you have Free Speech TV, you can check it out on Free Speech TV. Caitlin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Great talking with you, and I'm looking forward to seeing the movie, Legalize Democracy. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the latest news and information you want to be hearing from the corporate-owned news media. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls, too. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It does begin with you. Okay, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Get over to movetoamend.org. And pdamerica.org, there's some great organizations. free-don.org. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.